we had probably about 4 weeks of cash left in the bank. Mm-hmm. And I was like, hey, we need to do something fast. Hey everyone, welcome to Shopify Masters, your companion for starting and scaling a business. I'm your host, Adam Leventer. Did you know that 30% of produce from farms never actually make it to the grocery store simply because they're not aesthetic enough? Divi Ojha created Odd Bunch to save the ugly produce that supermarkets reject and deliver them to customers for 50% less.
We've been profitable from the get-go. We've gone from 87 customers to now in the six figures.
Farmers make more money, families can save hundreds of dollars, and our landfills aren't nearly as full.
People have started to make decisions very consciously about what they're buying, why they're buying it. They're part of something bigger than just getting a box shipped to their door.
Divi is here to chat all about disrupting existing systems and developing a loyal customer base. Divi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
If you were to describe Odd Bunch to a layperson or to your mom or to a perfect stranger, how would you describe the business and what you guys do?
I would say that Odd Bunch is a online subscription platform that connects imperfect or surplus produce from farms, greenhouses, distributors to households in the community.
So as a subscriber, I can just click get produce shipped to my door. Is it the next day?
Depending on where you live, it could be next day. But yeah, essentially that's exactly it. You could shop on the website and choose exactly what you know what box you want and save anywhere from 30 to 50% on your grocery bill while reducing at the minimum on every box 12 pounds of food that was otherwise destined for landfills.
And the frequency of these shipments, are they coming monthly, weekly?
Weekly is default. Perishable nature of produce, most shoppers typically do stock up once a week or in about 10 days. So that's why we went with the default being weekly. But there's consumers that are on a bi-weekly or a monthly. It is flexible.
And I'm getting an automatic shipment unless I cancel my subscription.
Yes, exactly. So you can manage it. You can manage your subscription up to 8 weeks in advance. So if you know you're away, you have the flexibility to skip, pause. But yeah, you're not tied into a contract. So you're absolutely able to cancel without penalties at any time as well.
So 100,000 households is a pretty far cry from 87, where you started.
87.
How long has it been now?
It'll be 8 years in a month and a half.
Do you see this as a major milestone? Or do you think like we are just getting started?
Both. 100,000 households, so that's a substantial amount of people. I surely didn't see it coming when we started. And for a very long time, it was not growing at this rate. But I do still think, yeah, we are just getting started, especially because of our product offering being so laser focused right now. I think as we continue to add that, we should get bigger within Canada.
Canada only. Four provinces.
Correct.
Ontario, BC, Quebec, Alberta.
Correct.
What's the percentage of households that Odd Bunch now reaches?
For us, the splits, Ontario is definitely our biggest market in terms of who can purchase a subscription. It's about 50% of total postal codes in the country. Hmm. So we've definitely added a lot in the last 9 months that's come off of the backs of the Vancouver expansion and Calgary, Edmonton, shortly thereafter, but they're both in their infancy stages. Mm-hmm. The markets are not. Ontario, we've been running under Odd Bunch for over 3 years now. So the penetration is just not comparable.
How did this idea start? When did the seeds get planted?
That's a tough one to answer. Honestly, I think subconsciously, it was the whole growing up with that culture at home where food was a very almost sacred thing that you just didn't waste, right? And it wasn't, not even a grain of rice on your plate was allowed to sort of still be there when you were done with your meal. And I guess that was part of it. And just growing up before the age of 16, living in four different countries, just being exposed to that sort of at the subconscious level, I think had something to do with it. It was the end of my first semester at Western when I was in my first year, where I came across articles about food waste and just seeing staggering statistics about how much never actually makes it off the field, is never actually consumed, while food prices continue to rise, food insecurity is rising year over year. So I think that was my first exposure. I didn't really think that there was a business there. It was just curiosity. And it wasn't until probably about 5-6 months later where things just kind of fell off the tracks with an internship. And I decided to see if I could take a crack at bridging the gap here between supply and demand.
Mm-hmm. Was the internship where you started to ideate?
I did. I wasn't supposed to, but I found myself not very interested. I was always a numbers person. I still am. I like numbers. I think of myself as far more analytical than creative. So I thought that was a natural progression to take up something in the field of finance and banking. I thought I'd enjoy myself, learn something. And maybe that was a bit of 18, 19-year-old ego where I felt like I was doing unimportant work. So I mentally checked out very early. It was like, I'm here. It's been 5 days. Why am I not doing something serious? Why am I not speaking to clients? Why am I not, right? Which I get it now, right? But in that moment, I think that is what pushed me away. And I said, okay, I want to do something where I feel like my work is valuable. I definitely was researching. In the 6-7 weeks that I spent there, I was definitely not focused on wealth management for all of it. But I think that was sort of my calling.
Correct me if I'm wrong, though. Between idea and first box delivery is something like 47 days.
Yeah, that's right.
That's fast.
Yep.
So what's happening during that 40 plus day period?
I've been asked this question and I've thought about it long and hard and I've come up with the term naive optimism. That's what it was, right? And I think every entrepreneur, every founder, especially the younger ones, need that, right? And I think at 19, I looked at the food system and I said, yep, I could fix that, right? And at 26, 27, you kind of realize, okay, there's a lot of depth here. But sometimes when you start looking at things, overcomplicating, overthinking, you never actually take the most important step, which is the first step. So I think it all worked out perfectly because at that point, you know, you don't know what you don't know. I looked at a problem, defined it, said, okay, I think this is what I can do to solve it. Let's do it.
What was that first step for you, looking back?
The first step, I think, was to verify that pain point existed on the supply side. I think that was a natural first step as any new founder, for first-time founder. I mean, I was obsessing over names and logos and how the brand would look and feel, but I think that fizzled very quickly and probably had a lot to do with my lack of skill in that domain. So I jumped to sort of my strong capability, which is I wanted to speak to people. I wanted to build that relationship. I wanted to verify whether this pain point, which was documented in articles, really manifested itself in real life. So yeah, I turned to Google, found this buy local, buy fresh flyer or pamphlet. I don't even know if they publish them anymore, for Chatham, Kent and Windsor, Essex and Leamington, that area. And I think it was like 47 farms on there or something like that. Just started calling them one after the other. And I didn't get too far with that approach. And it had their addresses on there. And I just was like, okay, if they're not going to answer my phone, I'll just drop by. Why not? Right? But I was smart enough. I was smart enough to not just go in and just pitch them on something and like try to sell them on my brilliant idea that I had come up with 6 days prior. First couple of times I'd drive down and just sort of understand, you know, why they do what they do. When did they get into peach farming? There was literally an orchard that I visited that was in business since 1881.
Wow.
Like, I was like, okay, it's a long time. So yeah, once, twice, three times. And I think by the third or fourth time that I just came down and said hello, they were like, okay, what do you want? Right? You're not driving from London every other day to say hello, right? So that was kind of the start of it. And yeah, they verified the problem. They verified that, yes, this is very normal. And, you know, in our local community, we try to share within, you know, our neighbors and family and friends. And if there's still product that we can't sell, then it's either animal feed or we sadly just have to dump it, right? And that kind of was the first, okay, it's real. I wasn't concerned about what scale or how much or what price. It was just like, okay, the problem's real. Mm-hmm. So I think that was a big, big first piece, big anchor piece.
What's the marriage between the pain point that those farmers have and the pain point that resonates with consumers? Is it food waste on a macro level?
I think it is food waste on a macro level. I think it is transparency. It is making intentional purchases. And at the end of the day, it's also about value. And I think that's the piece that's really grown tremendously. I think value is the reason why we have gone from 87 customers to now in the six figures, is because people have started to make decisions very consciously about what they're buying, why they're buying it. You know, since about 2020, there's definitely been a bit of an uplift in being okay with the idea of not seeing or touching or feeling your groceries before they show up to your door. So adoption from that standpoint has also gained momentum. But I think for consumers, it is knowing that they're part of something bigger than just getting a box shipped to their door.
As a founder, were you looking at other use cases, either south of the border or globally, and saying, look, this business model has worked in these markets, it's just not here yet? Or for you, was this sort of net new?
For me, it was net new. But by no means was that the first time that the idea was being executed or implemented. Because even in those early conversations with the suppliers, like, the business model wasn't there. I had verified the problem. I was like, okay, there's commodities that are worth not much to this grower that I could perhaps purchase, but then what? Right? So that piece hadn't crystallized. And it wasn't until probably the week after where it was like, okay, if I can orchestrate collection between, you know, these six farms that are in Chatham, then I could probably create this bundle, right? And maybe people could choose between the bundle and get more of tomatoes and less of peppers, whatever. And I would bring it back to a place and I would then sort it and then deliver it. Like, that sort of crystallized afterwards. And yeah, I started looking at businesses that existed that were in the space. And at that time, I think there were a couple in the US that had just started. I believe Hungry Harvest was probably about a couple of years old at that point. Imperfect Food, I think, or Imperfect Produce, it was called back then, was about a year old. And largely the most dominant player in the market globally today, Misfits Market, didn't exist. So they actually, they started in 2018. So yeah, the space has evolved drastically in the last 8 years. And the US was definitely a couple of years ahead of us, even when we were starting.
Okay, well, let's talk about the demand side for a moment. So you're out talking to farmers, you recognize there's a problem on the supply side. The demand for something like this is a whole other question. So you spin up a brand, you call it Food Fund. And you get a buddy of yours to design like a front-end website or something in exchange for a ride?
Yeah, essentially. So yeah, the scrappiness and just getting stuff done unconventionally is definitely a theme.
It's the mark of a good entrepreneur.
I guess so. Or just, there was just a relentless focus of I need to get this done and I can't do it myself because I'm not skilled enough and it would take me too long to learn it. So what do I do, right? So yeah, I had a hunch that demand would be there. I wasn't concerned too much about demand. I was concerned about supply in the beginning because I figured if I could sell someone something for 50 cents on the dollar and have it show up to their door and they're doing something that's good for the planet, why wouldn't you do that? I was sold on my own story. On demand, and actually got a lot of pushback from the suppliers. I got pushback from the farmers. They were
saying,
like, well, why do you think anyone would buy this? We can't sell it. I was like, that's fair. These guys can't sell it. These guys have been in this business 130 years.
But they're selling to grocers or distributors?
They
like
had, I mean, some of them.
Distribution channels? Or,
some of them. I mean, their primary business was selling to a bigger distributor that would then ship it off to a retailer. But they all had their little farm stands and like farm markets. And they'd have people in the community sort of drive by and just buy from them. So in their experience, they struggled selling some of those grayed outs even to people in the community. So they're like, why would, you know, how are you so confident that you could take it for 20, 30 cents on the dollar? No problem. Are you sure you're going to be able to sell it? So, and then that was sort of my piece where the demand side started to crystallize, said, okay, I need a website or at least a landing page turned to Shopify. So this is quite a full circle moment, I guess. And that's where I call a buddy of mine who was at that time, he'd finished up his first year at Waterloo in Soft Eng. I called him. I remember I called him and he was just like, what do you want? He was packing. And he was like, I don't have time. I need to get to Richmond Hill. Like, I need to get out of here. This is my last day here, student res. I'm like, how are you getting there? He's like, well, I don't know. I'm like, well, I could drop you. I could help you pack. It's like, what do you want? Right. I'm like, no, there's nothing. I'll come hang out. Got there with my laptop. I'm like, look, I'll pack the rest of this. You just do this. You focus on this. Get me a landing page by the end of the day. He did it. Simple landing page, couple of products, few photos, checkout, good to go. And I was like, okay, now.
Transactional.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was like, okay, now what? Right? And I have this domain and this page and whatever, but it's like no one knows it exists. So that was the next piece.
Your buddy spun up this website. It's fully transactional. It's ready to go. Well, what's next? I mean, it's the marketing. It's the awareness.
Yep.
Where do those first subscribers, those first customers, where do they come from?
Yeah. So this took a while. So we had the website ready, well, a while, 10 days, but that was a while. I hadn't thought that far. So we kind of hit a bit of a dead end there with a nice website, simple, good to go. But every day I would go on there, the app, and it'd be zero sessions, zero visitors. And then, you know, maybe I'd look at it three times and it'd go to three. Said, okay, people need to know, okay, what do I do? What's the highest leverage tool that I have? Didn't have very much money. So I mocked up a couple of flyers and figured, you know, my time is worth very little right now. Might as well get these printed and just walk around the neighborhood. Knock on doors, talk to people. I can do that decently well. So I said, you know what? This is probably worth my time. Did that. Didn't do too well. Did okay. No one bought anything, but there was encouragement, enthusiasm. I don't know if they just felt bad for me in like 35 degree heat with flyers sweating. Maybe. And then I was like, okay, something's got to give. Like I can't walk around the city. That's not good enough, right? So I remember there was a lady who was at a farm actually at the same time that I was there talking to the farmer. And she was overhearing some of these conversations and she was like, oh, this is a great idea. You should post about it in a mom group. Like I said, mom group? I said, yeah, on Facebook. I said, I'm a 19-year-old male, right? And she was like, no, they'll be okay. I know like a couple of admins in the London area. Like you could, I'll message them. I said, okay. 2-3 days later, I was in the groups and I made my first post and got traction and people were commenting like, oh, this is a neat idea. Started by a student, like it has a feel good factor and it's like, maybe I'll try it, right? And I remember it was a mom group and it was a vegan group. There were two that did really well. And I think that was the first sale on the 16th of August at like 10 a.m. That was the first time we sold a box and the app went cha-ching. Oh, that
it wasn't a subscription at the time.
It was? Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. We had
from
it all.
From day one.
Yeah, we had it all set up. That was a piece I can take credit for because I was like, okay, this is not recurring. So then I went and configured the back end with Bold Subscriptions, it was at that time.
A shout out to Jay Myers at Bold Commerce in Winnipeg.
Exactly. Yes. So that was sale one. And kind of then I went down this rabbit hole of joining virtually every mom group that existed in Southwestern Ontario till the point they got sick of me. But I would say the majority of the first 87 people that signed up in that 10-day activation period, probably 80% came from that group.
When did you pivot from Food Fun to Odd Bunch? And what was the reason for the rebrand?
It wasn't a choice. So we never wanted to pivot, right? I think we were committed to, and I was very sold on the idea that customization was the business and people wanted to choose and people valued tailoring their subscription to their needs. And if that piece didn't exist, the business would not be successful.
So just so listeners understand, when you say that as a consumer, you figure that I want to choose right down to the last apple, banana, carrot, what I want in my box every single month.
Correct. That was my hypothesis that I didn't really test very deeply, but I was again very convinced that that was the case. So that was the direction we started building. It was a subscription, build a box, and you could go in and configure it based on your likings. And there would be a set amount of products that you could pick from and they would rotate based on what's available. And the model worked. Where things started to get a little bit complicated was when we started to pivot from produce to now start dabbling with non-perishables or less perishable food, like shelf-stable, pantry, and all that kind of stuff. And our SKU count started to creep up. And we got to 200, we got to 250, we got to 300, and it was madness. The operational side of it was just, there was no consistency, there was no foundational processes that were repeatable across subscribers. And yeah, we grew partly through the COVID, sort of that 6 months where a lot of people turned to online groceries, but it was short-lived, right? Because there were loopholes in the way that we were packing and fulfilling orders. Like, it just was not something that was infinitely scalable, at least not without significant capital.
Okay. And so today's version of the model is courtesy of that pivot, right? Where subscribers every month get a box of fruits and veggies. And it's by what? Number of family members? Is it by weight? What are my choices?
Essentially, there's really three parameters. You decide whether you want a conventional box or an organic box. You decide whether you want a mixed box, an all fruit or all veggie. And you decide whether it's small, medium, or large, right? So it's really three choices. And we break it down by the number of people in your household to give people a sense. And we also list out exactly what you can expect in each box every week. That was sort of our happy middle between removing that customization piece where you couldn't choose exactly what was in the box, but you knew exactly what was in the box. Mm. So if there was things that you knew you were not going to eat, you could still substitute them. Or, you know, if you just thought that this week the box is just not for me, you could still skip it. We weren't sending you things that you were going to waste anyway. That would be counterintuitive. So that was our happy middle. And yeah, the pivot was, as I said, it was not really a choice. We got to a point where the business started to decline because they, as I said, operationally, we were just not efficient. There were packing errors and fulfillment errors, and it just, the burden of carrying that SKU count across so many geographies with suboptimal scale just basically eroded margin. And we got to a point where we had probably about 4 weeks of cash left in the bank. And I was like, okay, we need to do something fast.
How do you level set expectations for your current subscriber base right now in terms of the quality of the products that they're getting? Because they understand the mission. They're behind the mission, certainly. They understand a lot of this produce isn't making its way into a grocery store for whatever reason. They get value on the dollar, sure. But what is their expectation upon receipt of the box?
That's changed as well, and has changed significantly, I think, in the last 6 to 12 months, by and large because of our commitment towards educating users through social media and just through making noise, right? Where people understand that they're not going to get things which are perfect looking all the time, but they don't need to settle for something that is subpar quality. And I think that was a big, big piece that we had to overcome, where people were on the fence and didn't want to take a chance where they got something that was substandard and said, well, no, sure, it's cheaper, but if I'm not using half of it because it's just coming rotten or moldy, that was a problem, right? So we tried to address it up front and really talk about it through our socials, where we had a good engagement with our community. And that's the piece that we've really doubled down on the last 6 to 12 months as well. And user-generated content, reviews, all those things help. A lot of the common first box complaints, if you will, are, what's wrong with this? There's nothing wrong with this. Why did you say it was odd? Right? So it's like there's a piece that's almost a complaint. It's like they were expecting things to be completely disfigured, when that's just not the case. There's so much that makes it into our boxes, not because it's wonky looking, but just because it's surplus. You can't control so many different elements in the food supply chain. And you could have 3 hot days followed by a rainy day and have too much yield. There's so much education to do, but I think we've been able to overcome some of these challenges and set expectations as to, it may not be pretty looking, but it will always be fresh. And sometimes you won't even be able to tell the difference between what you've been used to buying for many, many years now and what shows up to your door.
How do you manage the supply chain now? You're working with, I think, 80 plus suppliers across, I'd imagine, multiple provinces.
Correct.
You have to ensure that they're bought into the mission, right? I mean, they are ultimately supplying you with your product. You can't possibly oversee, from a quality control perspective, you know, 100,000 plus boxes that go out on a monthly basis. So is there a certain element of trust that you have to have in your suppliers and your supply chain? Just walk me through that aspect of things.
Yeah, the short answer is yes. There's a lot of trust. And that's not exclusive to us in the industry. I think this industry, and for that matter, probably all perishable food products, operate on a level of trust, right? there's processes, don't get me wrong. And there's a reason why there's 20 different grades of carrots and 20 different grades of apples. Because someone in the Okanagan needs to be able to communicate to someone in Newfoundland what this product is, right? So it's well thought out the way that the industry codes things and refers to things. But when you play outside that domain, right, when you say that, okay, we're not looking at Canada grade A, we're not looking at the fancies and the extra fancies, we're looking at perhaps grade B, grade C, sometimes ungraded product that's mixed into an 800-pound bin, right? Those lines and those codes are very quickly blurred. So yes, there's a lot of trust. And then over time, there's a need to develop internal systems. Although we've got a good working relationship with most, if not all, of our growers, we've taken it upon ourselves to allow them that liberty and that flexibility to send us product. And we're accountable for going through and doing quality assessments and quality checks.
Your team.
Correct. And I think that was a big piece of that buy-in from the supplier side, where they've been burnt before, right? They've sent stuff, they've sent product to enthusiastic buyers that said, oh, we'll take the not so perfect grade, and eventually to have to deal with refunds, to have to deal with credits, to have to deal with delinquent customers, essentially, that basically took the product and never paid because, mm-hmm. the product wasn't good enough. Right, so that was a big hurdle as well, where they bought into the problem, but they knew that what had happened in the past. So for us, it was almost, again, how do we win that trust? And taking that responsibility, saying, listen, you send us what you think you have, we'll deal with it, right? And now, I mean, we've obviously at 5 suppliers and 10 and 15, it was very different. At 80 or 100, now we've got processes in place where if we realize that, you know, the kind of the 3 strikes and you're out, where if we're getting product and it's where we know that it's just being dumped on us and we're not getting much yield out of it, that impacts how we do business with said suppliers. So we've dialed in that process. So it's a calculative trust, I would say.
Does that rule apply to the what you call the 3 visit rule as it applies to suppliers?
Yeah, it kind of is an extension, isn't it? But in this industry, the margin of error, the margin when it comes to the economics, it just isn't there, right? And we pride ourselves in being very fair and very reasonable with our farms, our greenhouses, our distributor, doesn't matter what size. And we expect the same treatment back, right? And in this volatile industry, you can't expect perfection every time. But if we see trends, if we see patterns emerging where there's just a disconnect in what we view as product that can fit into the box and I guess the supplier just is not on the same page, then yeah, we do have to sort of pull back.
How long were you growing this business organically? What I mean by organically, pun intended, I mean without paid media spend, without paid marketing, exclusively through, you know, guerrilla tactics, word of mouth, et cetera, mom groups. How long was that chapter? And when did you start to actually implement a more scalable marketing strategy?
Far too late is the short answer. For the first almost 7 years, we never really looked at paid advertising as something that we were ready to do. Partly because, again, capital was not free flowing, right? And perhaps at the time that was a source of frustration. But looking back at it, I think that was the biggest blessing. We were forced to operate relentlessly lean, and that has set us up for where we are today. But I do have a degree of regret to not necessarily identify the product market fit earlier, and I'm not sure what the delta would have been if we had started to implement some of these paid marketing tactics earlier, and guess we'll never know. But we definitely waited for very, very strong feedback to come through. And that was after the Odd Bunch pivot. And literally last year, November, is when we brought on a performance marketing specialist, our very first core marketing hire after 7.5 years in the business.
So talk to me about how you approach marketing in the context of this role and this set of capabilities. Do you look at you know, how efficient your media spend is across channels. You know, you establish your marketing budget for any given month. You say, okay, we're spending, I don't know, $20,000 a month. Let's look at the return on ad spend here across these multiple channels and let's double down on what works and what doesn't. Is that how you approach it?
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. I mean, the name of the game for us is to be efficient, really, whether it's operations, whether it's marketing, whether it's any other front of the business, because we don't have the room to not be efficient. We pride ourselves on providing unmatched value when it comes to the product. That's what consumers and subscribers have come to expect of us. So largely that room to experiment beyond reason doesn't exist. So absolutely. For us, it was just a matter of, first, it was a matter of producing content. That was something we identified very early on as a piece that was driving the organic growth, was just filming and putting up videos or text or static graphics. That was bringing eyeballs, so that we started doubling down on that and had certain posts do really well without the added media spend. And then sort of started piecing those pieces together and really formulating an early strategy of, okay, we can, you know, if this does well, these are the metrics we look at. That's how we've gone about it.
Mm-hmm. To date, you've not raised any outside investment and there is no debt on the business. I mean, it seems to me, one, congratulations, that's incredibly rare. Two, the business isn't 7 months old, it's 7+ years old. So again, well done. But to get this business to the next level, do you ultimately think that you'll have to raise?
Tough question, isn't it? Never say never, right? It'd be silly for me to sit here and say, no, we'll never need capital. That's just, yeah, short-sightedness. We'll need to continue to make good decisions on what that capital looks like. We've been profitable from the get-go. We haven't had a single loss-making quarter in the history of the company. So we're in a position where we could use debt, right? There's a case to be made with debt being used as an accelerator for the business. And that's definitely a consideration. On the equity side, I'm just not sure. I think a big part of why we've been able to do what we do comes from being nimble and being very morally and ethically grounded in making decisions that we feel are right.
Not wasting food, not wasting money.
And I have a perhaps irrational fear that if there were investors or institutional groups that sort of started to really operate this business as a vehicle to make free cash flow and strictly free cash flow, then we'd lose some of that. And I don't want to do that. So park that for now.
How are you measuring how engaged or loyal your subscribers are? Are you looking at lifetime value over time? Are you looking at your monthly retention rates or churn in any given month? And if you're comfortable sharing metrics, would love to dive into that.
Of course. Yeah, we look at all of the above. NPS is a big one for us. Referrals in the first 4 weeks is what we found is a killer metric. It's a predictive metric of retention, right? And, you know, I heard somewhere, someone said, virality is rented, retention is owned. Hmm. And that one stuck. Right. And we look at our business, and I think probably the single most impressive metric of ours internal business metric is retention. We track retention on a cohort basis, on a quarter basis, on an annual basis. We track retention by geography. We track retention by product type, product variant. So very analytical in the way that we look at things. And we've got 53% net retention at 12 months in a direct-to-consumer grocery space where publicly traded meal kit companies are
20 to 30%.
Yeah, if that. So
if that.
I was reading something with HelloFresh that pegged them at about 12 to 15% once you got rid of reactivations, which is a very interesting way to make the numbers look a little prettier. So three times sort of the industry is where we're sitting. We look at CLTV, like customer lifetime value. Mm-hmm. We look at customer lifetime value gross margin, which is again a big lever. Yeah, a lot of fun stuff on the retention piece.
Can we clarify one metric for viewers, mm-hmm. which is that first one, the first 4 week referral rate?
Yeah.
Is that what you said? So you're measuring whether or not an existing subscriber refers a new subscriber?
Yeah, that was an experiment that we actually ran. And it was, I mean, obviously it wasn't run in a very tech forward way. it was, and still is, sort of spreadsheets and pivot tables and graphs. But I had, again, the hypothesis was if someone feels like they've now become a champion for the brand or have convinced someone to do something that they themselves started doing, there would be that extra stickiness. That's what the hypothesis was. And when we actually tested that, and we looked at the same cohort that signed up in, let's say, June of 2025, and we looked at in July of 2025, the folks that had successfully referred at least one person, their retention at 6 months was an order of magnitude higher than the folks that hadn't.
Yeah.
Right. So it really makes you think more critically about what your life cycle journey truly looks like. How are you talking to the customer post-purchase? What are the pieces of content that you're serving them? How are you turning that first box moment into a habit?
Mm-hmm.
What is the psychology behind that? How you can get people wired to think certain ways? It's fascinating. And about a month and a half ago, we actually brought on our first and only lifecycle marketer on the team right now. And yeah, really looking forward to building that piece of the business.
The referral stuff is so interesting because it's an area of the business. And when I say the business, I'm saying a business model like yours, but this applies to basically any D2C subscription model, which is the fact that a lot of these teams focus on, you know, they've got acquisition related teams and they've got retention related stuff going on. Nothing much related to the actual referral strategy for the company. What I find surprising is that if you can execute referrals at scale, you've got a pipeline of new customers, of new subscribers that are coming in the door at a zero customer acquisition cost, right? So from a marketing perspective, that's your most cost-efficient channel right there, is mobilizing your existing customer base to then drive new customers to your brand, to your company. Agree with this?
100%. I think that's, well, for the first 7 years of our business, that's the way we grew, right? And it wasn't that we were thinking about it in year one, but that is what was actually happening behind, you know, within the machine, is consumers were having a good experience and they were telling the person down the road. They were telling their friends, they were telling their colleagues. That was when we sat down and actually started to see those pieces crystallize and really look at, okay, now we want to formulate a paid marketing strategy. We want to focus on growth. It's not even close. You can't even compare, right? And especially with looking at the paid media space now, it's not what it used to be, right? You really have to be good,
yeah.
Right? And good creative gets rewarded. Not so good creative gets crushed.
Yeah.
So when you look at a community of now, you know, 100,000 users, it's so much more powerful to try and activate that and turn them into brand advocates that continue to drive that vehicle forward 100%.
Quick rapid fire questions for you, then we'll wrap. Any tools, systems, software that you have found beneficial as it relates to marketing and customer acquisition?
The generalist answer would be Klaviyo, wouldn't it?
For email.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's been a big piece for us.
How about for monitoring and measuring these metrics that we've called out? LTV, retention, cohort level churn tracking. How do you measure all that stuff? What systems do you use?
Smile has been one that we've played around with in the past. On the referral side, yeah, Referral Candy is one that we've used quite a bit. And as, again, part of the Shopify ecosystem, those would be my two, I guess.
What do people get wrong about the food industry? What are the top three misconceptions that people get wrong about this space?
There's some controversial ones, but I think one of the biggest ones is looking at retail as the biggest offender when it comes to food waste. That's a big one. I'm not saying they're perfect and angels when it comes to waste, but I feel like they're at the receiving end of a lot of that. Another one, big one, is at the consumer level, is that my habits and me changing what I'm doing will have no impact is a big one. I think, yeah, the data proves otherwise, right? Over 50% of food waste actually does happen in your home. So I think those two are probably the two big pieces, at least in the grocery side.
What's next for you guys? You're at 280 employees. You're now serving over 50% of Canada at this point. What does expansion look like for Odd Bunch? Is it more Canadian provinces? Is it more countries? Is it a U.S. entry? What is it?
it's definitely more Canadian provinces, more Canadian cities. We'd like to see our reach get into the 80% of postal codes by the second quarter of next year, hopefully. And I think the next big piece, or the next big no-brainer for us, is to really look at other value-added streams. Like, we just came out with our own cold-pressed juices. And that's just extending our supply chain expertise into a different product. And food waste doesn't stop at produce, right? So perhaps there is a future where we look at shelf-stable grocery items as a part of our supply chain. But that's probably what the next 12 months are about.
Well, I, for one, am going to be a new subscriber. So there you go. Davey, thanks so much for doing this, man. Really appreciate it. Great to talk to you.
Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. Leave us a comment, drop us feedback right here below, and make sure you're subscribed to Shopify Masters. We'll see you at the next interview.